Wait a minute, I've got. Okay, it's I'm recording. I've got it. I just did it. It says it's recording. So I guess it's working now. So I'm doing it on this computer. I'm gonna have to find it later, but whatever. But anyway, we got it. It says it's recording. So David, can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I'm getting ready to drop off because I'm going to be late.
I'm recording. It's telling me it's recording.
All right. Bye. Robert, I'll catch you on tape.
Okay. Talk to you later.
All right. Okay. All right. So who's hosting? Am I before?
You are.
Okay.
It's all yours, Ken.
All right. Well, I guess we wait till 7:30 and do all the official stuff. And so, like, you're ready to go, I guess.
I'm ready to go, but I'm gonna stop my video for a minute and run get a drink, and then I'll be
Sounds
back.
Good. Sounds good.
Okay.
Sure.
You'll know I'm here.
Okay. Who do we have? Recording. Okay, so I'm got that. It says it's recording. How many people do we have? All right.
Test.
Okay, good. You are. Okay, good.
Hey, Ken.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, I was going to say you need to let people in. I see you.
Yeah, I did. It looks like I'm default hosting right now, which is fine. I'm letting people in as they show up.
Hello. Sorry for cutting it close. I had another Zoom meeting I had to set up for Dallas Philosophers Forum and then drop out of. So I had some technical issues with that. So.
Well, you're still
but,
on.
Sorry to give you a scare. Just make. Yeah, I did know that, so I felt double bad about it. But I'm gonna make sure I'm silenced on this other one, so it's not gonna interfere. Okay.
Okay. So David's muted on our feed. Can everybody hear me? Okay. We'll wait until Robert comes back and then we'll go ahead and start.
Okay. Just give me one more minute, okay?
No problem.
You might tell David we're looking at his ceiling.
Well, we're seeing the. Okay. Well, he went blank here. At least on mine, he went blank. He's still, no, there he is. Okay. There we go. So. We'll see what happens here. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Well, we got a pretty small crowd this week.
Well, it's still early.
Yeah, well, we might get some more people showing up. But you can't get any cheaper than this. All you have to do is just hook up on your computer. Six participants right now.
I find myself oddly in possession of myself on two different windows. I'm not sure why that is.
Oh, I don't know. I'm seeing your video feed.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
So I don't know if there's anything I need to do. I think we just kind of let you go ahead and do it. But anyway, I guess we might as well go ahead and get started. This is... Hey.
If you'd like, it's supposed to start at 7:30, right?
So we
can go ahead and wait till 7:30. Why don't we just go ahead and do that? We'll just go ahead.
Because there may be more people signing on.
Yeah, probably will be. Right. So we'll just give them a chance. So how are you doing, Susan?
Hanging in here. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Things aren't bothering me too much. My life is mostly normal. Except for a lot of masks here and there, but whatever, you deal with those. Yes, can I do that? I'm not sure how to do this.
Okay.
I'll get a few more people dropping in.
Yeah.
Hi to Chloe.
Yeah. Okay, my co-host, there you go. Okay. How do we do this? Hey, Robert, when you speak, you set your screen to be the main screen, right? Can you do that?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I mean, you need to be the main screen when you're speaking.
Right. So what people need to do is up in the right-hand corner where it says view.
Right.
There's a view that has like lots of little squares. That's where everybody's the same size.
Right.
Oh. And then if you click on it, you see when it says speaker.
Okay.
And then that'll focus on whoever's talking, presumably me.
Right. Okay. All right. So if
you click that speaker thing, then for example, right now it should be me.
I don't see anything that says speaker, but.
On my computer, the person speaking has a highlighted box around them.
Yeah, that always happens. But right up in the upper right-hand corner.
Yeah, I see view.
There's a view thing. You click on that and it should come.
Oh, speaker. Okay. So when you're highlighted, I hit speaker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I see.
Then the bigger, whoever's speaking becomes the big person.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Making it wise, by the way, for everyone else to mute.
Right.
Look, otherwise, every time they cough, the screen changes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think I can mute people.
You have the power.
Yes, I can do that.
But that doesn't mean if someone wants to ask a question, they shouldn't jump in and ask.
Right. Well, we can do that in question and answer time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's no problem. I don't think it was anyway.
Dr. Hunt, have you spoken to the Philosophers Forum before?
Oh, yeah. I have. The last time I had to have been pre-COVID because it was at the El Phoenix, I think.
Oh, yeah.
3 years ago or something like that.
That was only for a short time we met there.
Yeah. So I've spoken to you all a couple of times in the last 10 years. But
yeah,
my association is through David Drum, who was my college roommate.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
I
didn't know that.
And who guided me into philosophy classes, although he later obviously went to the dark side and became a lawyer. But, I mean, he and I have in common that we both teach courses in world religions, but his is about a million times longer than mine.
Well, Dave was a pretty good teacher, too.
It's incredibly in-depth.
Yeah, we got a smaller crowd than we had last time.
Maybe that's because I didn't understand my title. It's okay.
What's wrong with the title? The word Brahmins?
Brahmins, I think, yeah, that's Brahmins. What's a Brahmin? Well, I'll try to make it make sense by the end. I'll tell you that if you have another opening, I co-hosted a conference on religious freedom on the SMU campus about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. And it was quite fascinating, the diversity of viewpoints on that. On that topic, let's just put it that way. It was organized by pretty conservative Mormons.
Okay.
Okay, which have their own total take on this issue. Not that there wasn't a wide variety of speakers, but I'm just saying it. You know, you start from a certain social location, and and it comes out a little different. The discussion comes out a little different.
Well, I was intrigued by your very brief abstract. If the question of religion comes down to values of diversity and human dignity versus a focus on reason or evidence, okay, I'm giving away my age. Whatever happened to soteriology? In other words, that which saves a human being. What kind of questions are we asking of religion anymore? That this is the topic of tonight's talk. So
we'll get to soteriology. It's never far from the background when in a Western audience. But maybe ask in a different way. We'll see.
So. Yeah.
Again, there we go. I want to welcome everybody to Philosophy Forum. We've been in Dallas since the late 70s, which is quite a long time. Bob Berman was our founding member, I guess, and I won't go through all of that, but we've been around a long time, been part of the intellectual life of the Dallas area for quite some time, had talks on all kinds of different things, very interesting subjects, which apparently there are enough people interested in to show up and listen to and participate, and we appreciate all of our speakers who are willing to share their time and their efforts to present their ideas to us and help us to think through some things. Tonight, we have the pleasure of listening to Robert Hunt, who is a professor at SMU and is going to speak to us about religion, emerging models of religious universalism, or are the Brahmins winning the battle for credibility? Well, I don't know. That might be an interesting answer to figure out. So if everybody would, let's just welcome Robert Hunt. And I'm going to sit you as speaker. If you want to say something, I think it's going
to. Okay. Yeah, well, let me jump in. And thank you, Ken. Thanks to David, who's not with us right at the moment, for the opportunity to speak to you guys again. I wish it was over a meal, but I'm sure that'll come at some point. When David approached me back in April, I wasn't sure exactly what I would jump in with, but I had this idea that I'd been working on with a class, and so I thought I would experiment further with you all. I will just tell you that it's more or less my nature to try to tell a big story and see if we can't come to the end of it and learn something. And so this is going to be a fairly big story. I think in 45 minutes, my plan is to cover about 4,500 years of human history. But we may skip over very large sections of it, to be honest. I think also to make this a little bit easier for you all, I'm going to go ahead and share a PowerPoint presentation screen. And I may, you yourself will see when I share the screen, it may come up full screen on you. You can go, actually, there's some options to make it less than full screen if you want to see something other than the PowerPoint. I think I'll be superimposed over it in any case. But I think sometimes it helps to be looking at the words while I'm saying them, right? So I'm going to go ahead and do that now. It's going to be a little tricky for me looking at both the PowerPoint and my notes, but I think I can figure it out if possible. So the emerging, it's going to be even trickier because I need to move it before I can read it. Okay, well, sorry, we'll go back. Emerging models of religious universalism, are the Brahmins winning the battle of credibility? And to put this in context, we're going to do a little bit of history, and I want to start with the Vedic religion. The Vedic religion is the religion of the Vedas, the Rig Veda is probably the name you know best of these ancient Hindu works. And the Vedic religion emerges into the history with the Aryan people. They move out of Central Asia into the subcontinent of Asia, in a period around 3,500 years ago or so, maybe 4,000 years ago. They bring with them a indigenous religion, and it's based on household sacrifices. Every Aryan household had a sort of a pit sacrifice with three different fires in it. And these fire sacrifices were made to a wide variety of deities. The Aryans also had a rigid system of class distinctions that we call the caste system today. That system developed as they moved into the Indian subcontinent. The word for caste in Sanskrit is varna, and it means color. So there's almost no question that part of the caste system was a matter of the assertion of the lighter colored people moving out of Central Asia over the darker skinned persons of the subcontinent. Okay. But that quickly changed with intermarriage and other things, and caste became a pure class system, less associated with color. In other words, there in modern India today, there are people of all castes that are both dark and light skin colored. As the Aryan people moved southward and eastward from Central Asia, they incorporated a variety of different ethnic groups into their growing system of political control. And just as they incorporated them into their social system with this by the means of caste, they also incorporated them into their religious system. And it was really a two-way street, and scholars debate about this, but the two-way street was that these indigenous peoples adopted the Aryan religion, the fire sacrifices to the various Aryan deities, but the Aryans simultaneously merged into their religious system all the indigenous cults of the subcontinent. So it was a very synthetic, syncretistic system that was developing. And eventually, although this is going to take place really after the Common Era, that system will be fully synthesized in two great epic poems or stories, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And these two stories then bring together sort of this rich religious mixture of Aryan religion and all these different cultic religions of the subcontinent into a sort of narrative coherence, let's say. Not necessarily a philosophical coherence, not a theological coherence, but a narrative coherence. And a work entitled The Laws of Manu would systematize and justify the social system and its ethics in a way that then gave this emerging civilization a certain coherence. Now, out of this engagement, there develops a threefold kind of religious life. And we're now talking about the period of around 2,500 years ago, although, you know, pinning it down to even a century is not probably not wise. But about 2,500 years ago, a system has developed in which that has three parts. And one is the household fire sacrifice remains a central religious object. Each householder maintains the sacrificial fires, performs the pujas or praise of the god, and burns these fires. At the same time, there begins to develop, and this is where we have the Rig Veda and the Upanishads, this philosophical and meditative religion that's built around reflecting on the meaning of the sacrificial religion in ways that become ever more esoteric and abstract. And I'll just give one quick example of this because this is not a lecture on Hinduism, right? But one example of this is if you have a fire sacrifice, then there's at least two things going on. One is you're taking fire and you're burning something. So you're transforming it into from raw meat or raw vegetables, either one, into smoke, which goes up and smells and this sort of thing, and into something cooked as well. At the same time as you're creating this transformation with fire, you're saying words, these pujas, these praises to the gods. So a question that arises, and this is what's going to lead to philosophical speculation, is what exactly is this thing called Agni? This is the Sanskrit root of all those words that begin with ignition, right? What is Agni? Is Agni a god, a transforming god? Is Agni the idea of a certain kind of transformation? What's the power? What's the meaning behind the fire? Not just the fire. And the same thing, what's the power or meaning behind the human voice? What is it that makes a voice effective? It makes it work. A voice can be, words can be reduced to sounds. And what are the effective sounds? What's the Ur sound? What's the most basic of all sounds, the most powerful and inclusive of all sounds? Once I put it this way, you're all going to know what it is. It's Om, right? This great Sanskrit symbol, Om. And how do you get from saying praises to the gods to Om? Well, you do it through a process of philosophical reflection that tries to continually reduce and refine and understand the meaning of the sacrifice. And the third thing is you have diverse public religious cults that take place among all of the Aryan people and all of the people they absorb, mostly involving the deities, gods, goddesses, etc., of the people that the Aryans are conquering. Okay. And eventually, although this will happen post the Buddhist era, these cults will become located in public temples. And so you the religion that emerges will always have an internal side, a household side, a household deity side, a household sacrifice side. It'll always have a public side. And the one difference between them is the household is going to be very much divided by caste. The public side is going to be very much cross castes. Okay. So there's threefold religious life develops. And then comes a challenge. And the challenge to this threefold religious life, and this is where we're going to begin to understand our modern world a little bit, is the challenge of Buddhism. The Buddha's teaching in almost every respect directly challenged the religious system of his day, the religious system of which he was a part, right? I mean, he was a member of one of the Aryan caste. He was a Kshatriya. He was a member of the warrior caste. And his initial efforts to practice religion were all within this Aryan religious framework. But when he becomes enlightened, he begins to teach something very different. The Aryan religion was fundamentally was basically a positive religion. It was oriented towards grabbing all the gusto. The old Miller Life commercial, you only go around once in life, grab for all the gusto you can get. That was very much the Aryans. They were not concerned about the afterlife. The use of religion and spiritual power was to succeed in this life, to do well in this life, to do the right thing in this life. The karmic system of life and rebirth, which was part of the Aryan idea, was understood to be a system where when I die, I hope I get reborn in a better way, right? It's every life is just the gateway to the next life, and you hope you do better. Buddhism taught that the karmic system was itself fundamentally not a system of good and getting better, but of suffering and discontent. That the whole karmic system was one that created suffering. And therefore, the role of every person is not to climb up the ladder of karma. The role of every person should be to get out, to escape, to achieve nirvana. Okay. So this system of gods and goddesses and puja and praise and sacrifice that the Aryan system had built up around doing well in this life, Buddhism ultimately rejects as just another illusion. The Vedic religion was very well of illusion, very well aware of illusion and that things were illusory and that you needed to see deeper into them. That was that whole philosophical meditative strain of the religion. But what Buddhism does is to show that the whole system of gods and goddesses, it's just another illusion, as is the caste system. So Buddhism rejects caste distinctions as totally illusory. The system of life stages that the Aryans had, where you move from childhood to being a student, to being a householder, to eventually retiring and sort of going full-time to seek a rebirth into a better life. That whole system of life stages that gave structure to Aryan society, Buddhism attacks that and rejects that as also illusory. And Buddhism then offers everyone without exception a path to escape from suffering. So basically, Buddhism was an exclusive system. It excluded the existing religious system as being true or useful and said, this is the only way. Now, we're not used to thinking of Asian religions as exclusivist religions because we tend to challenge them to balance them with Western religion. But Buddhism is at least, and was, a converting religion. You became a Buddhist, you left behind your old religion, and an exclusivist religion because its fundamental claims about the nature of reality excluded the possibility that the older Aryan religion was true. Now, that Buddhist religion was enormously powerful. And from the period of about 2500 before the Common Era up to about the beginning of the Common Era or 100 years afterwards, Buddhism swept the Indian subcontinent. It became the dominant religion of the Indian subcontinent. And in fact, it although it did not destroy or set aside the Vedic religion, it certainly displaced its sense of power in society. And in particular, some kingdoms, Ashoka, for example, become Buddhist kingdoms. And of course, this marginalizes the Brahmin, the priestly caste. It marginalizes the sacrifices and the gods and the deities and all of that. But then about, and here's what I want us to recognize and here where my thesis comes from. In the first 200 years of the Common Era, the teaching of the Brahmins, the teaching of the priestly class, begins to make a comeback. It begins to reassert itself. And they did it in a way that both embraced but also undermined Buddhism. So on one hand, the Brahmins generously said, Buddhism can be accepted in our system as just another one of many paths of seeking release from the illusions of the world and rebirth into a better life. Right? So it says we don't have to compete with Buddhism because in our system, any path is a valid path and Buddhism is thus a valid path. As a result, the Buddha as a teacher, Buddhist practice, and the Buddhas as deities could be integrated into the Brahminic system. So the Brahminic system, in a sense, became so broad that it could incorporate both dualist and non-dualist understandings of reality. Dualists and non-dualists might be mutually exclusive paths, but in the Brahminic synthesis, they were both legitimate paths. So the Brahmins would assert that because all paths of human spirituality and religion ultimately lead to Brahman or ultimate reality, then all exclusive claims are illusory. All exclusive claims are illusory. So the attack on Buddhism from the Brahminic synthesis is this: if you claim to be exclusive, you are in fact the illusion. Okay? The one unacceptable claim, the one false claim in the Brahminic synthesis is the claim to know the only truth or the only path. And this turned out, for a variety of social and cultural and other reasons, to have been brilliant. And what emerged is what looks like modern Hinduism today. It swept back through the subcontinent. Buddhism was almost entirely eliminated from most of what is modern day India. Residing much further east then, where Buddhism moves very effectively and successfully into China and Japan and Korea, parts of Southeast Asia, and the island of Sri Lanka. But from the subcontinent, Buddhism almost entirely disappears, and the Brahminic synthesis wins. And it wins because it says, there are many paths to God. All are acceptable, including the Buddhist path. The only unacceptable claim is to claim to know the only truth. So why am I asking today, are the Brahmins winning? Well, I'm going to think about that for a second and take a sip. I need some fortification here. Let's think about the pre-modern West now. Okay. The history of religion in the Mediterranean basin since the advent of Christianity has been one of exclusivist religious claims. First, those of Judaism, then the Christian church, then of Islam. each of these three religions, we can call them the Abrahamic faiths, or sometimes called Western religions. Each would, at different points in its own life, broaden the idea of who could expect to be saved. Someone brought up the question of soteriology. All three of these religions were deeply concerned with who was going to be saved. And they could have broader or narrower ideas of who could be saved. But however broad they might make their idea of who could be saved, they all agreed that any teaching that contradicted their particular revelation was by definition false. Any practice that contradicted their religious practice was going to be ineffectual. Any ethic that contradicted their religious ethic was going to be misguided. And that any worldview that didn't conform to their particular understanding of the creation of the universe was irrational. Now, of these three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, over history, Islam and Judaism would be more tolerant of religious difference than Christianity, both for reasons internal to their religions that we don't have time to go into. But, for example, neither Islam nor Judaism could accept a religious system in which multiple gods were worshipped, or they were worshipped through the form of images. That was idolatry. It's anathema to all three religions. None of the three religions could accept that ultimate reality was formless being, Brahman, rather than a god that had distinctive characteristics that had been revealed. So, for example, when Islam came hard up against the religion of the Brahmins with the Mughal conquest of India, it might accept for the sake of political expediency that Brahman, ultimate reality, was the same as Allah. But the truth is that was a fairly thin veneer of sophistry that frequently gave way to persecution and mutual antipathy. When it wasn't possible to politically dominate the entire Hindu world with a handful of Muslim soldiers, then it was wise to accept that Hinduism fit within the system. But it was always a very dubious kind of fit, and neither Hindus nor Muslims then or now necessarily get along too well together. The arrival of Christianity in the subcontinent didn't change the situation. And the mutual antipathy of the three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Hinduism, has been played out ever since, and it's being played out right now in India today, and in Pakistan and elsewhere. So these have not managed to come to a Brahminic synthesis that would allow them to exist. Now, as it happens, the Enlightenment would come along and would undermine the key religious teachings. Let me just go to the next slide here. Yeah. The key religious teachings of all three of the Western religions. But it didn't do anything to alter the Western bent towards exclusivism. And I think we have to understand this. The Enlightenment had made vast changes in our culture and society that we feel today. But the Enlightenment project was to seek universals. It was seeking truths that were applicable to all of reality and all of humanity in the natural world. And once you found a universal truth, of course, this is going to exclude other truth claims that don't fit with that universal truth. A kind of an Enlightenment theologian example of this is Friedrich Schleiermacher, the father of liberal Christian theology, who created a brand new Christian theological system that took into account all possible religious sensibilities. Schleiermacher is writing through the 18th century. So he's writing in a time in which Buddhism and Hinduism and the Asian religions are beginning to be well known. He certainly knows of Islam. He has a copy of the Quran in German. He understands Judaism. He has Jews as neighbors. So he creates a theological system that can account for all these different religions that he knows, and that includes Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, and Catholics. But he wants to account for them within a universal system of religion. And that means that ultimately he ranks them. He puts them in order. And from lowest to highest.
We got it. Thank you so much. All right.
Okay. Bye-bye. And it won't surprise you that in Schleiermacher's universal system of religious understanding, guess what the top is? Protestant Christianity. Actually, he'd probably say Lutheran Christianity, right? Because he's a Lutheran chaplain. So yes, he's got a system of universals, but it but through its hierarchy, it excludes the fullness of truth to every religion but his own. Okay. Simultaneously, Western philosophy is going to gradually free itself from religious ideas and ideals and will seek epistemological and moral absolutes that could ground the emerging political structures of Europe and the United States. And you're part of the Philosopher's Forum, so I don't need to talk to you about Descartes, Locke and Hobbes and the development of Western philosophy and Western political philosophy. And science. As science develops through the Enlightenment, it begins to seek ways to methodologically distinguish between true and false claims about the nature of reality. For the most part, science would become materialist and thus reject or at best ignore truth claims that could not be empirically demonstrated. Even now, many cosmologists, and I think this is interesting, reject the idea of a multiverse. Now, we probably heard this idea of a multiverse, right? Why would a scientist reject the idea of a multiverse? Well, because at this faith in scientific history, it's an article faith rather than a demonstrable reality. It's not scientific in the strict sense. It's a kludge to deal with the fact that why do we have this universe, right? Even postmodernism, even the rejection of the Enlightenment idea of a meta-narrative, hasn't really reined in the exclusivist nature of the claims of science, philosophy, and frankly, still the three Western religions to effectively describe the world. At the same time, I think we can see that the Enlightenment is a kind of a Buddhist moment in Western history. It's a moment when a brilliant new description of reality, the Enlightenment description of reality, replaces that old pre-modern world, but in this case, as with Buddhism, with an exclusivist set of claims. Okay. The initial religious response to the Enlightenment by Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, if you guys can come to my class two nights from now, and I'll hold forth on this for 3 hours, but you probably don't want to do that, actually. The initial Enlightenment response to this was by these religions was eventually, and they Judaism and Christianity were first, Islam came a century later or so, was to assert that they were indeed enlightened religions. Each of these religions would try to adapt to modernity and to assert that their truths, as all Enlightenment truth needed to be, were evidence-based and rational. To a greater or lesser extent, they became part of this Enlightenment project of asserting that which was universal, but also exclusive in its claim to the truth. So far from sort of opening up, all three religions in their Enlightenment mode simply adopted an Enlightenment form of exclusivism. Okay. So I'll press on here. I hope you're taking notes. But at the same time that this was happening, something new was going on. And this is, I think, what is critical. Charles Taylor describes this in his book, A Secular Age, how through the Enlightenment, and despite the efforts to create Enlightenment, exclusive Enlightenment religions, despite the efforts of religion to take on board science, empirical reasoning, and this sort of thing, despite all of that, things are happening and changing within our self-understanding as human beings, which change what Taylor calls the condition of belief. And to put it very simply, his book is 600 pages long, but get the Cliff Notes version, okay? He repeats himself a lot. But the gist of it is, and I think he makes a strong argument, what emerges in the West, or he would say the North Atlantic countries, what emerges in our culture or civilization is a condition of belief in which every person knows that non-belief is a possibility, even if they're a believer. So he contrasts this with the pre-modern situation in which you only know how to be a believer. The possibility of non-belief isn't a possibility. You could adopt a different belief. You could become from Christian to Muslim. You could go from Muslim to Jew, possibly. No, probably never. But actual atheism was not a possible option within the culture. And in fact, we know this from literature. The literature of the 14th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, the word atheist does not mean a person who doesn't believe in God. It means a person who doesn't believe in God the right way. Okay? But in our modern era, atheism becomes an actual possibility. It becomes possible to cease believing and to, in fact, seek one's meaning in life or human meaning in life in a purely immanent framework, to eschew all that is transcendent, to live totally in the domain of the immanent. Now, that doesn't exclude the possibility that you can believe in God or gods. It only excludes the possibility that your belief can be naive, that you can hold it without always having somewhere in your consciousness the idea that I could change tomorrow. I could quit believing tomorrow. So Taylor says that naivete vis-a-vis belief has been denied us simply by our social and cultural location. Now, I want a quick note here because I think this is important to say. Taylor is careful to say that he's talking about the North Atlantic cultural world, and we could say its colonies abroad, every big city, this sort of thing. But it's also important to realize that given waves of immigration and the slowness of cultural change, that it's quite possible that there are many non-modern people living in our modern society, right? Taylor says it's possible for everybody, but what he really means is everybody that has a certain kind of educational experience, okay? He doesn't mean that this cultural change has actually embraced every single human being that happens to live in the North Atlantic world, but it's there, it's present. And if it's present for you, then you, Taylor would say, you've become a modern person and your naivety is gone and you don't really have any choice. Okay. Now that gives us a new standpoint from which to evaluate the world. If the standpoint of non-belief is possible for the modern person, it's imaginable for me, and we're aware of that possibility of standpoint, then from the place where both belief and non-belief are possible, we are able to now survey many possible belief systems, many possible religions, and many possible spiritualities. If we can choose between belief and non-belief, then we can choose between non-belief and many different possible beliefs, okay? And that means, for example, that when we read a textbook on world religions, it's not merely interesting anthropology or sociology. It becomes a smorgasbord of possibilities for our own engagement of reality beyond the material world. And I see this. I've taught world religions now for about 35 years. Much of it outside the U.S., but the last 15 years within the U.S. And what I'm seeing, and I can see the change. My students no longer read a world religions textbook as an anthropological study of those other people. They no longer read it, if they happen to be more evangelical, as a sort of setup for how I'm going to share the gospel. They read it as a primer on possible forms of spirituality that they might make their own, because they understand themselves to be in possession of options. And these books become a book of options. I saw this played out in an interesting way when Houston Smith spoke before he passed away at First Unitarian Universalist Church in Dallas. And Houston Smith, of course, has written one of the great books on world religions. And almost all the questions to Houston Smith, then a very old man, were about this. Well, what do you think of this? And, you know, what do you think of this and this? And Houston Smith's a great scholar and a truly balanced individual, trying to do his best to present in all their integrity all these different religious faiths. But he would answer again and again, well, I'm not really sure because I'm a Presbyterian Christian. I made my choice. And it didn't include being a Hindu or a Buddhist or all these other things that I describe. But many people reading his book was a book about choices, and maybe even a book about syncretistic choices, how I could combine Buddhism and Hinduism and maybe a dab of Islam and a little bit of Judaism, right? And this gets to sort of the key point that I want to make in this talk. And that is, because we can now see that we have a plurality of choices, and because we now know that our choice is only one choice among many, it's hard to assert that our choice is and must be the only valid choice for everyone. To deny that the other choices are not real choices is to deny the reality of our own choosing. It is to deny that we have actual human agency. It's to deny that we are actually finite humans who have to choose. Saying there are no other religious choices is simply to say that our act of choosing was not a real act, that we were caught up in some deterministic process beyond our control. We cannot really have human freedom at its fullest and an entirely exclusivist view of religious truth. Our own human dignity demands real freedom to choose, including our real freedom to choose. And that's not just a political right, that's a philosophical assertion. Our human dignity, our personal human dignity, no matter what choice we make, depends on the fact that there was a real choice to make. Put another way, if we find ourselves free not to believe, then our sense of our human freedom changes in a fundamental way. We've found a harbor of belief, true, but we cannot forget that there was an ocean out there that we were once on. And if we remember there was an ocean, then we know that there are other harbors and other choices, and they still continue in the back of our minds to call to us. This is why Charles Taylor says, we live in a place where we have a supernova of religious options. Because the minute we're aware of one option, to not believe, we become aware of all the other possible options of belief. Okay. And so, pure exclusivism undermines our own sense of agency and freedom. And in that sense, the something like the Brahminic synthesis, which accepts the equal validity of all possibilities, comes our way. Now, I have to note in closing, though, that what is happening in our culture is different than the Brahminic synthesis in a fundamental way. The Brahminic synthesis would be characterized ultimately as one God but many paths. But our contemporary situation is better captured by there may be a God and there may be many paths, but then again, maybe not. The one thing the ancient Brahmins did not imagine was the possibility of a purely immanent reality. And that possibility, for better or worse, stands open to us. Now, I'm going to just briefly close with talking a little bit about science. I've talked about religion. What about science and the scientific claim often made, or scientist claim, you could say, scientistic claim, that all truth belongs in the realm of immanence? Well, increasingly, this assertion that there is only one valid approach to reality is being called into question by scientists themselves. Steven Weinberg, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, a self-professed atheist, also points out that cosmologists are in their own way Neoplatonists who believe that the equations they come up with are more real than the empirical observations that might support them. And in his book, Dreams of a Final Theory, when he gets to the final end, and he confronts the fact, he says, actually, as a scientist, I have a genuine choice before me, belief or to not believe. And so what's the justification for not believing, right? What's the justification for pursuing his science, he says. And he does not offer any empirical, scientific, rational reason for it, because he knows there is none. That's to work from within the framework that you have to prove that you exist. Instead, he says, because he believes that not believing raises human life from farce to tragedy. It's a very poetic assertion of why he puts faith where he puts his faith. Something a little less poetic and dramatic is found in Marcelo Gleiser's book, The Island of Knowing, Island of Knowledge. The title makes this clear. What Gleiser, who is both a philosopher and a PhD in cosmology, writes is that that science is an island. He says it's a growing island, and it's got a fractal shoreline of infinite length, but it's only an island. And beyond what is the island is that which is not only is that which is unknowable by science, and which has to be admitted as unknowable by science. And so Gleiser again will say that he is happy to continue his work expanding the shoreline of the island of knowledge, but he also recognizes that there may be other things to be known and therefore other ways of knowing them. Okay. If physics isn't your bag, by the way, then we think of neuroscience. I've just been reading some books on neuroscience and artificial intelligence. A description of human consciousness remains elusive. For neuroscientists, it is the so-called hard problem. We know that consciousness somehow depends on the physical brain. We just don't exactly know how. And this comes to the fore evermore as we develop machines which may or may not possess intelligence. And is the intelligence of an intelligent machine the same as human consciousness? And how would we know? Right? How could we interrogate the machine to see if it's conscious like we are? However intelligent it is. All of this lays, and by the way, what about machines, intelligent machines that are now manipulating our human consciousness, right? Through deep learning and algorithms that are actually so-called black box algorithms, where the decision-making of the machine isn't known by the people who programmed it, right? It's creating its own processes that it doesn't communicate out to the programmers that started the process. Wow, well, these are deep problems. Another time, maybe. In short, we're moving into an era in which exclusivist religious claims offend our sense of human dignity and freedom, so exclusivist scientific claims also seem naive, given the multiple realms of knowledge and thus knowing and consciousness that we are aware of. In short, it's not a straightforward time for those who want certainty in either their religion or their science. The possession of such certainty, a source of enormous comfort, also undermines the human dignity that is built on freedom and agency. More than ever, to know is not only to know that you cannot know, but know what cannot be known. Whether we find a functional synthesis of all the diverse ways of knowing as the Brahmins did remains to be seen. In the meantime, to quote my favorite anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, we have no choice but to see by available light, never fully certain if we are at the dawn or the twilight. And I'll end there. And wow, I did it in 45 minutes. I appreciate myself for that. And let me ask if there's questions. I'm going to de-share my screen, okay, so I can see all of you all again. And
okay, yeah. I guess everybody can hear me since I just unmuted.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you've got a question, I'm going to try and put this in a view where I can see everybody at the same time. It looks like I can't. But
my answers will get better if I have another sip of wine.
Okay. Well, yeah. you have that option. So if you've got a question, raise your hand. If there's I'm not sure how to use the hand figure, raise your hand thing, or if you raise your hand, I'll just call on you. So who's going to have the first question? I'm not seeing. Does anybody have a question?
I'm going to raise my physical hand.
Yeah, that's good. That's the way to do it.
Okay.
I'm going to raise my physical hand, not being able to figure out where the little digital hand is. So I find myself asking, Okay, religion is a human activity, like music making is a human activity, scientific inquiry is a human activity. What is it that we're doing when we're doing religion? What is its purpose in human society? Social, epistemological, ethical, what is the purpose of religion?
Okay, so that's really a good question. And until the modern era, the answer would have been pretty straightforward. Of course, it was a way of relating to the transcendent.
Right.
Okay. Of course, what's happened in the modern era is that that answer remains a possibility, but there have been efforts then to explain it as a human activity in human terms. And these range from the idea that religious myths developed as explanations for natural processes, something like the Golden Bough, Taylor, the early anthropological views. Sigmund Freud's understanding that religion is a way of working out psychological traumas that come about. So there's a psychology of religion. Sociologists of religion have tried to understand religion as a phenomenon that develops to strengthen human societies, or particularly to strengthen power structures that keep some people in power and keep some people out of power. There's a field of study that believes that religion emerges out of our linguistic structures. And then I'll tell you where the current state of the field is, right, if I can say so. And the two groups that are duking it out right now are the groups that say religion is about power, and that's all it's about. It developed as a means by which certain social groups in society maintained their power over other groups and maintained their hierarchy. And the other view that says, no, religion is about meaning. It is the way by which humans make meaning or find meaning for their lives. And those two are not necessarily mutually exclusive, as you can understand, because it could be a method of making meaning that also is a method by which I assert my superiority over you. But that's kind of where we are. In where I work in the theology school, we're more on the meaning-making side and relating to the transcendent side than the power side. But I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good answer.
Sure.
Yeah, I think David's got a question. There we go.
Yeah. David.
Okay.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, ahead. David.
Okay. Okay. At the age of the Enlightenment, Voltaire, you know, with the ascendance of science, et cetera.
Right.
Many intellectuals, you know, of Voltaire's ilk, believe that religion would just dry up and go away. And mm-hmm. It didn't. In fact, it's even stronger in places that are supposedly enlightened and secular, like the United States. Mm-hmm. In your view, with globalization, the internet, you know, coming into contact with other cultures and other religions, what do you think the future of organized religion is?
That's a good question. You know, Charles Taylor points out that we live now in a world in which we have a supernova of religious options. We went from two, believe or not believe, to like a gazillion, and with not believing still being one of them. The question's complicated by the fact that here in the United States, we tend to be very individualistic. And so we see these as personal options, and social media and other things means that we can connect and form a community around a relatively limited set of, you know, around a very personal option, but we can find other people that are close to us digitally that may not be close to us physically. It does seem to be that in this time of a supernova of religious options, which has really existed since, you know, I'm thinking of us in Texas society, since the Hare Krishnas were marching around in the 60s and reminded us that you could also join them, right? It seems that always, though, it comes back to the formation of communities. that that as people find religious options, they also find each other and they form communities. And almost then by definition, you have organized religion. The organization may be very small and local, but there's also an enormous tendency for these communities to seek each other out and find each other and develop new sorts of connections. So I think organized religion has a great future. It's just not going to look like it ever looked. It's future.
Do you believe like Newberg and Angeli or whatever in their book, you know, Why God Won't Go Away, that it's wired up here?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And, you know, efforts have been made. A guy named Andrew, can't think of his name right now, has done some studies, brain imaging studies, to try to indicate that religion is a natural function of the brain. Others have made this assertion. You know, I guess I would say that the empirical evidence is that it's hard to make religion go away just based on what we see happening. Part of the hard problem of human consciousness is the chicken and the egg problem. If our human brain and our consciousness is built with the capacity to believe in the transcendent, is that like a byproduct of evolution? Or is it part of the source of who we are that actually comes from the transcendent? And I think when I state the question that way, you can see how hard it would be to design a test that would choose. Mm-hmm. Right?
Non-scientific.
Yeah. But it's also not scientific to assert that it's just a byproduct of evolution, like musical ability or something like this, you know, some other non-useful evolutionary function, simply because the time comes when it doesn't seem to be helping us in an evolutionary way, and yet it remains. Mm-hmm. We don't evolve out of it, or we haven't evolved out of it. So, these are all good questions, and they're the kind of questions that leave people scratching their heads and wondering.
Okay, who else wants to ask a question? I'm trying to catch anybody raising
their hand. I think I see
Skip.
Skip.
Yeah. Okay, Skip. Let's Skip in. What am I doing here?
Can I just go ahead and ask the question?
Go for it.
Okay. I've been a card-carrying physics teacher now for 50 years or so.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's important to me, and one of the things that I teach, is that if you're going to say that something is true, mm-hmm. you should be able to support how you got to that conclusion. How do you know something's true? What, that to me, a more important question than what do you believe is, how do you know what you believe is true?
True. Yeah.
Do you think that it's important for people who have religious beliefs to go through some process by which they understand why what they believe is true? You understand the question?
Yeah, that's a good question. The short answer is yes. I think it's absolutely essential. Okay. I will tell you that it was easier to make that case when I was a student in the 70s than it is today. Because we live in a cultural world in which if I ask my students to demonstrate in any form of rational way at all that what they believe is true or has a claim to true, then a significant number of them would say, because I feel it. I feel it. The my personal authenticity guarantees the truth of my beliefs, or my sense of authenticity guarantees the truth of my beliefs. And of course, this leaves us in a position where we can't adjudicate between conflicting claims. Right. So I think you're exactly right. And I think it's deleterious personally to society that we don't take our religious beliefs and put them up to some form of adjudication where we have to explain ourselves to others rather than just make the claim. But at this moment in time, that is difficult to do. And it has put an enormous burden on university professors and teachers who still need to have a discussion in a classroom, right? It's put a it's put a significant burden on our court system, as we've seen in a few recent cases before the Supreme Court, and we'll see many more of them because of the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts and the religious the institutionalized persons and Religious Use Land Use Act. Congress has essentially written into law that any individual's claim that anything is religious is a valid claim in court. And that's reflective. I think that was clueless on Congress's part, by the way. They just wanted to win religious votes. But it is indicative. Congress has been known to do that, by the way. Those were both widely bipartisan bills, 100% support from both Democrats and Republicans. But it's indicative of where we are in society, that the claim that this is the way I feel, or that the authentic me feels this way, has become a substitute for my making a claim that another person can check on, right? Can check the facts on. And it infects the academy to some extent, not to a big extent, but I have a colleague who asserted to me on a matter of science, right? And I said, well, yes, but you know how you know this is true is because there's studies involving 35,000 people with certain protocols to demonstrate this and this and this and this have demonstrated that this is the case when this assertion is made. And her answer is that all such studies, and in fact the entire realm of science, is controlled by the techno-fascists. And that the only thing that can claim to be true is that which cannot be checked. That all processes of checking what is true or false belong to the man. And therefore, only wild assertions that cannot be in any way checked have a claim to be true. Well, I guess the discussion's over, right? But yeah, I think you ask a good question. In the realm of religion, it's become particularly difficult. So that can make me feel like an old man sometimes, but I don't mind still slogging it out with the 25-year-olds.
Do we got another question?
Any other questions?
Anybody else? Just pipe up. I think you can unmute yourself. Not seeing anybody excited about it.
I'll pipe up, but
please, I'm not,
go ahead.
Since everyone's silent, I'll go ahead and try to articulate something. It seems like religion is something that emanates from the limbic system.
Mm-hmm.
Unconsciously, I have developed certain modes of behavior based upon the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can rationalize my behavior because it makes me, I have feelings of safety, mm-hmm. or status or some other feeling. And then I construct a belief that that's the reason that is. The lady that you were just talking about that said that, well, those fascist, whatever, techno, whatever,
yeah.
She was protecting a belief that she has unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like you, where's your evaluation of religion as it relates to limbic system modalities and, yeah. Unconscious protections?
I mean, I have to say, I think that's a great question, and it's a really good observation. So a certain part of evolutionary biology, the understanding of consciousness, is that we use the top part of our rational brain to try to systematize that which lies much deeper in a set of emotional responses that were useful at a certain period in evolutionary history to get us by. And then then it sort of takes on its own life, and we lose track of the origin, right, in the limbic system. I'm not sure that that's something. I think that's an interesting theory that's very difficult to demonstrate. I'll put it that way, because the reports, what we have to work on when we try to understand religion is the self-report of religious people, right? Certainly, we could say that with the Enlightenment, or even prior to the Enlightenment, with the evolution of religious consciousness, there becomes a conscious effort on the part of religious people to free religious belief from emotion and feeling and to establish it on an entirely rational basis of some sort. Okay, so it's not that religious people haven't been unaware of either the far before they were a view of evolution, of the sort of claim that religion was both basically emotive rather than rational, and to free religion from that. Whether that's been successful is another matter. I guess you could say that most modern religious people believe that, in fact, religion has been successfully freed from that, or would say, yes, we're indeed conscious that this can be the origin of religious feelings, but we believe we can show rationally that there's a nonetheless they refer to a transcendent reality. And that would be similar, I think, to I'll put it in the words of a friend of mine in an entirely different discussion about emotions, who said, yes, I know it's all hormones coursing through the brain, but it's still real. So the sort of short answer to that is, just because you can explain the mechanism doesn't mean that you can deny the reality. And this is especially true in when it comes to consciousness in general, or knowledge, or epistemology. How do we know anything becomes important. It's this odd thing that we find where we know how to turn off consciousness, right? You turn off the brain, make the brain go away, and consciousness goes away. But we don't know where it goes. And we now have an interesting, I'm just going to offer you this. I know we need to wrap things up, but I'll offer you this to read up on, do a little Google search on the experiment that they did in Yale with pig brains. Okay. So the experiment was this, I think it was the medical school at Yale, may have been biology, but they contracted with a slaughterhouse, and when the slaughterhouse cut off a pig's head and drained it of all its blood, they cooled it down and delivered it within 4 hours to the researchers at Yale. The researchers at Yale hooked its vital arteries up to an artificial blood that they had created, a set of nutrients, which they then ran through the pig's brains. Okay. And what they discovered was that something like 90 to 95% of all the neurons, the cells in the brain, woke up and continued to function. They took a dead brain and turned it back on. Now, was it conscious? The answer is they don't know. And the reason they don't know is because ethically, they couldn't do that. So in fact, included in their chemical compound in which the neurons would come back to life and begin to respond to electrical excitement, they included vast amounts of opioids, essentially. Because what would be worse than turning back on a pig brain that could feel itself, right? I mean, so they suppressed consciousness, but successfully did get the pig brain kickstarted again. And of course, those of us who've been under general anesthesia before know the same kind of thing. Consciousness seems to disappear for a period of time and then take out the drugs and it comes back. This is going to pose a huge number of interesting ethical questions, because as one writer in Scientific American put, reporting out on this science, he said, the fact that we know that we can revive a person who is brain dead, in theory, means that we will figure out how to do it in fact. Who is going to deny when someone brings their 4-year-old child who drowned and says, start the brain back up, who's going to say we shouldn't do it?
That's right. That's right.
And we've matured past the place where we thought that you were dead if your heart stopped, because we now have defibrillators all over the place, right? We're long past the, if you're breathing, Everybody learns artificial resuscitation. So brain dead became how we know you're dead. Well, what if brain dead doesn't mean you're dead anymore? I mean, you could talk about massive, you know, massive destruction of the brain tissue. That's another matter. But yeah, I'm sorry. Your question took me off in another direction, but you see the problem.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of continue that and relate it back to religion a little bit. That obviates the possibility of the theoretical brain in a vat. Supposedly, if you know, we could take your brain or my brain and take it out of this thing and put it in a nutrient thing and keep it, quote, alive, and then feed it experiences, feelings, imaginations, beliefs, you know. could we not feed it that God is alive, that God is real? And, you know, and then where does really God fit into this? Does he make the brain, or do we make the brain, you know, and that sort of thing?
Well, or do we make God? I mean, this is kind of where this all leads. And
it's science fiction right now, but it's going to be maybe real one day.
Yes, sometime. I don't know if you know the Stephen Neal or Neal Stephenson novel, Fall, F-A-L-L, or The Life of Dodge, I think is the subtitle, Neal Stephenson, where he takes up in his usual witty and characteristic way this very set of questions. And I think I'll leave with this, because sometimes what Neal Stephenson calls speculative fiction is a place to go to look at speculation about some of these ideas that both religious people and scientists haven't yet quite figured out the language to use. Literature sometimes takes us out beyond that. I have my students in my doctoral seminar reads Antigone by Sophocles. We have a 2,500-year-old play that's obviously fictional, and yet every time they read it, it's immediately alive with the questions we ask today. So sometimes that's where we have to go. Okay, it's 8:30. I think that's our contract time with you all, but so I'm going to turn it back.
Okay, then I guess we'll do is unless somebody's burning to ask a question. I don't see anybody burning to ask a question. So I guess we'll end it there. And we'll stop the recording, and we'll see everybody next time. And thank you, Mr. Hunt. Appreciate it.
Thank you all. I enjoyed it.
This was fun. Thank you.
All right. We'll see everybody next time.
See you.